dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. There are few people that I've had the privilege of working with over a longer period of time who have fought harder about and in many ways contributed more to our understanding of this battle space than our first guest. He is Dr. Daniel Pipes. He is the founder and president of a marvelous organization based in Philadelphia, the Middle East Forum. He is a columnist, an author of innumerable books. I think it's 12 at the last count I had, but I'm losing track, I'm sure. He is found in all of the right places in terms of editorial pages and commentariat, and it's a great privilege to have him with us to talk a bit about this anniversary of 9/11, Daniel Pipes. 12 years on, I'm anxious to hear what your thoughts are as to where we are in the war that kind of formally began on that day 12 years ago. Welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, and good morning, Frank, and thank you for the warm introduction. I would suggest that this so-called war on terror really began much before 2001.
Indeed.
But instead, with the coming of Ayatollah Khomeini and the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979, the seizure of the American hostages then, that to me was really the opening salvo.
I agree.
And 9/11 made it just that much more apparent. Mm-hmm. So how are we faring? I would say overall pretty well, and I think more optimistic than most of my colleagues, probably yourself included. What? On the counterterrorism front, pretty good. The elaborate plots tend to get disrupted. The spontaneous, small-bore terrorism is much more difficult, what I call sudden jihad syndrome. People coming out of nowhere, engaging in violence, that has not been stopped, indeed has increased, but that has limited reach. More importantly to me than terrorism, however, is the advance of Islamism, of political Islam, both in the majority Muslim countries and in the West, and events like the largest demonstration in human history in Egypt at the end of June, the significant demonstrations in Turkey at the end of May and part of June, suggest to me that there is a pushback, that Muslims are waking up to the dangers of Islamism. And also in the West, I see that a threat that was virtually invisible before 9/11 is now quite a bit on people's minds. I hear a lot of people saying how badly things are going, to which I say, well, you know, I think they're going pretty well because you are worried about it, and so many other people are worried about it. So I am generally seeing things go in the right direction.
Well, I'm heartened by that, needless to say, though I must say I'm probably a little bit more skeptical. And one of the reasons I am skeptical, Daniel, is that while you're certainly right, there has been some pushback, most notably in Egypt, against the Islamists and their agenda of Islamic supremacism. Here in Washington, most especially in the Obama administration, but I'm sorry to say, including in some Republican circles, notably Senator John McCain's, as well, a continuing willful blindness at best, and at worst, cluelessness to the point of malfeasance, I think, about the nature of this threat. Talk a little bit about that as a contributing factor in where we are and where we're likely to go.
And there are many more examples in the press, sure, law enforcement, military, business, corporations. You can point to many, many such examples, and I will concur with it. That said, I would say in response that the body politic here, and even more so in Europe, is increasingly worried about this. If one looks at Europe, for example, just 2 days ago, there was an election in Norway. And it looks like, for the first time, the Progress Party, which essentially is focused on Islam, immigration, will be part of the government, which is more, for example, than Wilders had. He was only supporting the government.
Yeah.
These are important steps, and I think this is just the beginning. And one sees more and more Europeans, and to a lesser extent Americans, Canadians, Australians, focused on this issue. Yes, McCain and others are mangling it, distorting it, but people are getting the message anyway.
Well, let's take heart from that, and I hope that you prove to be more right over time, especially given how far down the tubes the Europeans have gotten themselves by their inattention to this problem before, and I'm fearful that we're perhaps closing on them if we don't take corrective action, as you've indicated. Dr. Daniel Pipes is our guest of the Middle East Forum, one of the country's preeminent authorities on militant Islam, the title of one of his many books. Daniel, let me ask you about Syria. You've written quite a number of pieces about it, including a very provocative one that at a moment when it appeared Assad was losing, we should actually help him so that it sort of ensures that neither of the very bad options here prevails. If you would talk a little bit about how you see things at the moment, the president's address to the nation last night, and most especially the question of whether there is in fact a moderate Free Syrian Army option available to us as an alternative to Bashar Assad.
Well, the latter question is easy to answer. No, there is no real alternative that is attractive to us. It's only degrees of unattractiveness. But the events of the last weeks have been dizzying in their rapidity and unexpectedness.
Did you say rapidity or stupidity? Trying to keep this straight.
I mean, the notion that the Secretary of State's offhand remark then turns into this major diplomatic initiative, I mean, who's ever seen such a thing before? But I'm very leery of this Russian initiative. I see an echo of the negotiations we have with the Iranian government, protracted negotiations, going over details, going back and forth, very technical, and months going by, nothing happening, and the whole thing just withering away. I see it as part of the larger incompetence of the Obama administration foreign policy, a foreign policy that's very much centralized in the White House, in the hands of people who don't really understand what they're doing. I think the red line statement of a year ago is a perfect illustration. It sounded good at the time, and now look what a mess it's gotten Obama into, and the rest of us as well. I hope that we focus away from Syria and onto Iran, which to me is the key issue. How Syrians are murdering each other is not a U.S. national security interest. And I note also that whether it be Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, Democrats tend to get us involved in fighting where we do not have central national interests involved, be it Bosnia or Kosovo or Somalia or Haiti or Libya or Syria.
Well, in a way, Daniel, isn't that kind of the inevitable effect of the application of this notion they call the responsibility to protect, that it's almost defined by the absence of our vital national security interests, which we would be attending to if that were the case, but instead injecting us into places where we don't?
Precisely. American foreign policy has two themes to it. One is national interest, and the other is humanitarian. And I think that the tension between them is a very constructive one. And I'm proud that we have this humanitarian theme. I do not want to be simply realpolitik. But you can't just be simply realpolitik, and you also can't be simply humanitarian. It has to be a mix of the two. And the Democrats have persistently, in the last couple of decades, or arguably since the Vietnam War, shied away from pursuit of national interest and wanted to use force to help other people, but the Republicans too. I mean, I still am shocked by the initial name for the expeditionary force to Iraq 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was Operation Iraqi Freedom. I think to myself, really? That's what we're fighting for? Iraqi Freedom? We're not fighting for Operation American Interest? So even Republicans have fallen towards this. It's what Michael Mandelbaum calls foreign policy as social services.
Yep.
This is not what we are have this great military for. It's not why we spend money. It's not why we lose lives.
Well,
we're
going to speak with Daniel Gray next about that military and the extent to which we are, in fact, possibly squandering what's left of it on these fool's errands and getting ourselves into a situation where I'm concerned, as I sense you are, Daniel Pipes, that we may not be prepared for the real problem that is certainly looming large, namely Iran. Dr. Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Forum, thank you for the great work that you do there and for your team and for joining us from time to time to update us on your thinking. Please continue to do so, and we'll look forward to particularly getting your sense as to whether we're getting this right as the president plays out his peculiar hand in Syria. Next up, as mentioned, Daniel Garay on the state of the United States military, the only one we have.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Daniel Garay, a man of considerable talent and expertise when it comes to matters involving the national security and the capabilities that we must have to provide for it. He is currently the vice president at the Lexington Institute in Washington, D.C. He served under Bush 41 as the director in the Defense Department's Office of Strategic Competitiveness, a man of many parts and always a great guest. We're delighted to have you back, Dan. How are you doing?
I am doing fine. Thanks for having me, Frank.
Wonderful. Well, I want to talk not just about your condition, but the condition of the United States military, most especially as we were discussing with Daniel Pipes a moment ago, what it suggests that the president is poised, if he has his way at least, to launch what I think of as kind of a Goldilocks strike plan against Syria. Not too much, not too little, just the right amount of death and destruction. He says, as he did in his speech last night, Dan, that this will entail modest effort and risk and save children from being gassed in Syria. Is there anything wrong with that analysis as you see it?
Well, other than the fact that the U.S. military is the one country in the world that can do this, which he did acknowledge, and do it because of its military strength, everything else really is wrong with it. The idea that we can calibrate not just the strikes, but the effects, political, moral, and all the rest, that carefully is just ridiculous. Secondly, that with the same incredibly small, to quote Secretary Kerry, strikes, we can both deter, degrade, and yet not incite any kind of retaliation or response. I mean, one finds it, I think I do, incredible that one can to have it both ways, as I might say, but that's what the president seems to believe.
We're talking with Dan Garay, vice president of the Lexington Institute. Dan, President Obama, he says, having arrived, I think, most inadvertently, not by design, at a point where the Russians have intervened on behalf of the Syrians and are now in the midst of promoting this idea that the Syrians will give up their chemical weapons. He's saying that we will maintain, basically on alert, the forces needed to execute this non-pinprick strike of his. We're hearing reports, Dan Garay, and I'd be interested in your take on this, that the plan has changed some 50 times since the decision was made to postpone it initially, awaiting congressional approval, that we're going to have now bombers delivering ordnance as well as cruise missiles. Knowing what you do, Dan, about the condition of the United States military at this point, what kind of burden is this going to impose upon them that they're told to just kind of pound sand, stand by, and be ready to go?
Well, this is now becoming, with sequestration and the president's own budget cuts, an incredible shrinking military, and we're asking it still to do more and more. Those five destroyers and the support ships are a valuable and scarce commodity in the U.S. military. And if you start to cycle those super everyone forward, they say you need three others in the pipeline. So you're really talking about, in effect, over the longer term, keeping 20 ships kind of tethered to this operation, much less the bombers. And since we're not doing big strikes, the only bombers we can use are the B-2s, of which there are only a handful, and which are a key part of every kind of strike plan we have, up to and including nuclear deterrence. So it is a tremendous wear and tear on the military.
Dan, one of the points that I think Daniel Pipes made very well was that looming on the horizon, or perhaps not so far down the horizon at that, is the prospect of a war with Iran over its nuclear weapons. Were the United States to become embroiled in what seems to me to be not a pinprick for sure, and probably not a short surgical strike either, despite all of the protestations of the president and his team, but in fact engaging in this civil war, as the Senate Foreign Relations Committee calls it, to change the momentum of the battlefield, what's the likelihood that this would degrade appreciably our ability to conduct operations, should we need to, against Iran as well?
Well, there's no question. If you sort of use up, for example, one of the carrier battle groups, I think we moved the Nimitz into the Red Sea, which makes it available, that doesn't become non-combat capable for days. You're talking about returning it after this operation for months, and those ships are very scarce. We've been talking about getting rid of some of them to save money. And then use up the cruise missiles. There are not a lot of them in the inventory to begin with.
Dan, I'm wondering if you'd address this, if you can. The Red Sea is not all that close to Syria, the last time I checked. There's a lot of real estate between. Normally, we would go through the Suez Canal to have that ship closer to Syria in the Med, wouldn't we? And why is it that we might not be doing that?
Well, this goes to the scarcity of the assets on one hand, because that ship, that battle group, is supposed to now be, in effect, doing double duty, keeping one eye cocked on Syria and the other eye, as you rightly suggested, cocked on our problem with Iran. Cannot be in two places at once, so they're trying to split the difference. The other reason is because of the extensive Syrian air defenses, which are focused primarily in the west, because of Israel and the like. And so you'd like to go around them by going through Saudi and coming up from the south. And that means long flight times, wear on the aircraft, the need for Air Force tanker support, all kinds of things that make this a bigger and more expensive operation if it occurs.
I wondered whether you thought that there might be some concern about our relationship with Egypt being such at the moment that it might be a little dodgy sending it through the Egyptian-controlled Suez Canal as well.
Well, of course, one of the problems is once you want to do something like that, you become more beholden to the military government, and clearly this administration has a terribly ambivalent attitude towards non-Islamic regimes in the region.
But the Chinese fleet did come through there, as I best can tell. And we find ourselves, Dan Garay, in a situation, I think most Americans are unaware of this. You mentioned the five ships that we currently have in the Eastern Mediterranean. I believe there's a considerably larger number of Russian ships, and now even a few of these Chinese warships as well. Does that signal a sort of changing character of the competition, shall we say, in this war for the free world?
This is deja vu all over again. We are looking at going back to the pattern we saw, for example, in the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, where the Soviets then put a fleet in between their clients and our fleets, the Sixth Fleet, right? So this is the biggest deployment by the Russian Navy in better than 20 years. Is it any coincidence that goes hand in hand with Putin's diplomatic initiatives, aggressiveness, what you can call it? I don't think so.
They understand the importance of power and how to project it and do so, I think, with strategic effect. Dan Garay is our guest of the Lexington Institute, formerly a senior official in the George Herbert Walker Bush Defense Department. Dan, let me ask you about the fact that given the stresses that you've described on our military, we find ourselves on the 40th anniversary this year of the all-volunteer force. Do you think that the cumulative effect of sequestration, budget cutting, more generally the social experimentation, the long deployments, the losing of wars and so on, is having a deleterious effect on morale and perhaps ultimately on retention and recruitment that keep that all-volunteer force a going concern?
You know, we haven't seen that. The evidence isn't yet in, but I think we are going to. One of the things that is going to go on is that with the military trying to shrink itself because of sequestration in particular, all those people who have done extremely well in the last decade coming off of war are real warriors, the people who served and did excellently in Iraq and Afghanistan, mid-level officers and such, are not going to find very good or even possibly any employment at their rank and in their specialties, and they're likely to get out, so they're going to get a bathtub. In addition, we are trumpeting that we're going to be cutting things like basic pay, housing allowances, all those things that we have offered for decades to these volunteers.
Even more unattractive to be part of this force. Daniel, I'm afraid we have to go. Thank you so much, as always, for the work you do at Lexington and for joining us from time to time. Keep it up, keep coming back, and we'll talk with you again very soon. Diana West joins us next. We'll talk about our government lying to us about the nature of the enemy we face. Is that contributing to the problem? Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Yeah.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Ginny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Efty with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last night, President Obama reaffirmed his fairy tale approach to the Syrian civil war. Like Goldilocks, he set on the just right outcome, not a pinprick. He warned the U.S. military doesn't do pinpricks, but not too much either. Rather, an attack, he assures us, will entail only, quote, modest effort and risk, and save children in Syria from being gassed, unquote. But then he said, we're going to wait for the Russians and Bashar Assad to eliminate Syria's vast chemical stockpile. Meantime, doubts about his plan are certain to grow, especially as a new YouTube video goes viral with a spoof of Obama supporters mindlessly crowdfunding his effort to start World War III. Unfortunately, unlike this funny video, what Obama is doing to make the world more dangerous is no laughing matter. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we are about this time each week, by our dear friend and much admired colleague, Diana West. She is a nationally syndicated columnist and the author of two remarkable books, one, Death of the Grown-Up, and most recently, the quite interesting and somewhat controversial new book entitled American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. And Diana, I want to talk with you about your new book, but let me set it up by asking you to comment on something we've been discussing in the course of the program to this point. The president's speech last night was the latest moment when he offered up this idea that if he has his way and can execute a military strike on Syria, it will be both very surgical, but it will also, as part of a larger approach to the civil war there, help enable and perhaps ultimately empower moderate factions operating in Syrian opposition ranks. Daniel Pipes doesn't know of any such folks to speak of, at least in any significant numbers. And I wanted to invite you to talk a little bit about the extent to which this isn't the first time that our government has misled us about the nature of what are actually enemies we're confronting.
This is an echo of what we've heard time and time again in terms of an American president asserting to the American people that by virtue of an American action, we can elevate, empower, legitimize good guys. I mean, we saw this recently in Afghanistan and Iraq in terms of American power allegedly triggering the elevation, legitimization, and entrenchment of a moderate pro-small-d democracy government. We have not seen it even in these recent times. We don't see it even in America domestically. I mean, our government has been empowering the most extreme elements in the American Islamic community, namely Muslim Brotherhood front groups that you and I have discussed many times. So our government is not good at micromanaging vast, messy conflicts where movement and fluidity is the name of the game, and bad actors are always scheming. It never takes more than a very concerted small minority to seize power in any kind of struggle. As we've seen going back to our own revolution, we had a minority of Americans, of colonists who wanted to break from Britain. Looking even more recently at the Russian Revolution, you had the Bolshevik minority, Bolshevik means minority, who seized power from the other revolutionary groups, including the majority group, which was much more compatible with Western notions of comity and diplomatic coexistence. So we've seen this notion that American presidents can move in these directions, and it is a deception. Whether it's purposeful or not, it is not borne out by history.
Mm. I'm afraid, endlessly mistaking the nature of those who are organized and disciplined and ruthless as people that we can do business with. And your book, American Betrayal, of course, documents how that began in earnest in 1933 with Franklin Roosevelt normalizing relations with the Soviet Union for the first time and doing so under certain, well, false pretenses and then lying about it afterwards. This analysis of yours has, I think, been brilliantly propounded by you in the new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, Diana West. It has engendered the most vitriolic criticism I can remember from within some parts of the conservative movement of any book. And you've taken to the pages of Breitbart News Network in recent days to offer up a very, I think, compelling rebuttal to a critical review that was published, I'm sorry to say, by my friend David Horowitz at Front Page Magazine, authored by Ronald Radosh. And I'd like to give you an opportunity just to talk, if you would, at least briefly about where the facts lie here, as they seem to be really so vigorously in dispute.
Well, I think the facts are not in dispute. I think that in the original Radosh Review, which spawned a remarkable series of copycat pieces based on the Radosh Review, again, not based on my actual book, it was a matter for me to go through the charges, smears, fabrications, inventions, mistakes, and lay them out for readers to make up their own mind if they're so inclined. What I truly hope readers do is just pick up the book, check it out of the library if that's the easiest way, just to ascertain what is true about what is being said. Because at this point, the debate has very little to do with the contents of my book. Going back to our original discussion in terms of the president asserting that you can do business with certain people and you can empower certain people and so on, you mentioned the relationship with the Soviet Union, which began, as you say, in 1933, based on essentially a series of agreements, a piece of paper, an exchange of notes that were notable for Russian promises, Soviet promises, to cease and desist from, or not even to embark on, any kind of infiltration, support for cadres of agents in America to overturn our government, to overturn our Constitution. And, of course, that was already underway when the United States signed this agreement with the Soviet Union. And after this agreement was signed in 1933, it ramped up to a massive point that I do argue in the book gave us a Soviet, an American proxy army, a de facto army of occupation, namely meaning a strategic density of agents, agents of influence, people working with the Soviet experiment uppermost in their minds, trying to bring it here in our federal government and related institutions, some of whom rose to right within reach of the levers of power at the State Department, in the White House, and so on.
Including the guy that has been described as essentially the co-president, I think, with FDR, Harry Hopkins. And again, this is not simply ancient history, Diana. You got into this, as I understand it, because of your interest, which you share with us regularly, thankfully, about penetration of our government in our own time, not by communists necessarily, but by Islamists or their friends. This contributes materially to policy, and whether one calls it an army of occupation de facto or otherwise, or whether one simply recognizes that you put enough of these folks in places where they can shape or at least have an influence on policy, you're likely to have, at a minimum, confusion about the nature of the enemy, whether we can do business with them, and so on, because we're being told that's so with the help of these agents.
Well, exactly. And what I was going to point out was that this leads to all manner of strange behaviors by our government. I mean, imagine the United States, the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Great Britain discussing Stalin in terms as Uncle Joe, a benevolent person. This man had already killed as many people as Hitler killed during the war. He had already killed that many people in his own slaughters by the time we strike a military alliance with him. So that's the kind of person he is, his own people. And he is presented as this benevolent figure. Communism is presented as something compatible with democracy. We compare that to our post 9/11 age. We are now at another grim anniversary. And we have seen the same kind of activity on the part of the federal government. Whitewashing Islam. We get hit on 9/11. President Bush tells us Islam is a religion of peace. This parallels greatly the attitudes promulgated by the federal government years ago about communism. And indeed, you see other similarities in terms of this new access of influence artists, whether it's on behalf of Muslim Brotherhood front groups today, or in the old days, it was actually secret, very much disguised agents of Soviet influence in yesteryear. And so we do need to consider these two ages as they parallel and realize we did a terrible job. We did a terrible job with it the first time around in terms of...
We're doing a pretty terrible job with it the second time around, too, which is particularly poignant because
yes,
we're living in this age, not reviewing ancient history. Let us just say that this lie business has most recently been in evidence in connection with another anniversary that we're marking today, that of Benghazi Gate, 1 year ago today. Diana West, your insights into these matters is deeply appreciated by, I think, all of us, and I very much value your contributions to this program. We'll look forward to talking with you more about them next week, but in the meantime, thank you, and thank you for bearing up in the face of some pretty serious assaults. Speaking of Benghazi Gate, next up, Colonel Dick Brower of Special Operations speaks on what we must now learn about what happened a year ago today. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Colonel Dick Brower. He is a man that I've come to know recently as a result of his work on behalf of a really remarkable group of men. They're calling themselves Special Operations Speaks. They have large and really impressive array of former special operators in the United States military who've come together to work on a number of different projects, most recently and with considerable effect, to try to find out the truth about an event that took place It's hard to believe. 1 year ago today in Benghazi, Libya, a murderous jihadist attack on a special mission compound, as it's come to be called, in Benghazi, and not too far away, a CIA annex. Dick is a retired special operator, rose to the rank of colonel in the United States Air Force, worked in the Joint Special Operations units, the Pentagon and elsewhere. A man, as I say, that I've had the privilege of getting to know a bit as a result of our collaboration on trying to find out the truth about what happened in the run-up to, during the evening of, and in the aftermath of what's come properly to be called the Benghazi Gate scandal. Dick Brower, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, sir. Thank you for your past service to our country and that you're engaged in, even as we speak. I know you're going to be speaking momentarily to a crowd in Tallahassee, Florida, about all of this. Talk a little bit, if you would, about what we know about what happened a year ago in Benghazi at this point and why we still know so little.
Sure. Basically, I think the answer to what we need to know in Benghazi is who gave the stand down order. I tend to think of Benghazi as a puzzle piece. And the puzzle piece, and I've said this before, is it's a jigsaw puzzle. And we're just after 1 year beginning to see some of the pieces. But the problem is the box that we get the jigsaw puzzle in has no picture on it. And the picture is the truth. And so slowly, very slowly, we're beginning to pull out pieces that reflect something that was going on there that we still don't know anything about. And we need a select committee to find out. We need a Watergate style select committee with subpoena power, and most important, we need the requisite security clearances so that intelligence documents, which are normally not privy to by the five standing committees, won't be redacted, just as Fast and Furious was. So we want to put these puzzle pieces together, and slowly, but very slowly, we're getting them revealed. One of the most important things I think happened is during the Senate Armed Services Committee, where Senator Ayotte insisted on yes or no answers and not soliloquies from General Dempsey, the chairman, and Leon Panetta. And she asked, did the president ever check in that night, that terrible night where the ambassador was yelling for help and so were our SEALs? And the answer was no. And the same thing for Hillary Clinton. The answer was no. Now, that puzzle piece was revealed months and months after the incident occurred, and only under Senate Armed Services Committee, one of the standing committees. So we need to have a select committee with the Watergate-like subpoena power to find out what really was going on there. Was it a CIA operation? Was it a State Department operation?
Mm-hmm. Colonel Dick Brower, let me again just make sure that we're all clear about what you've just said. There are five standing committees in the House of Representatives. They produced several months ago now a summary, an interim report of their activities to date. It seems as though this shouldn't be that hard to ferret out. Where was the president, for example, as you say, during the hours that this attack went on? Some 7 hours, all told. Who was in touch with the military, which, as I understand it, was very anxious to mount a rescue operation? And was there a direct order not to proceed, or was it simply that there was no order to proceed that was sufficient to have the same effect? Why is it so hard to get to the bottom of this, do you think, Dick?
That's a very good question. And again, where did that stand-down order come from? There's only really two places, or one place, that it can actually come from, and that's from the National Command Authority, which consists of the President and the Secretary of Defense. And now, was that implicit? Was that based on an advisor? Obama has many, many advisors around him. And what was going on that night, particularly the fact that he got a briefing early on and then disappeared for the night. So did he give guidance that someone interpreted? Did he get a recommendation from individuals like Valerie Jarrett or Tom McDonough or some of the other advisors, Tommy Vitor, or all these people that are around him all the time that we never know what they're saying? And that, of course, has to be passed down through the military chain of command, because we know that as soon as within 1 hour, there was a 1 hour and 10 minutes exactly, there was a drone overhead,
And the ambassador had immediately called for help. And at that time, there were at least 16, maybe more, command posts that were seeing real-time intelligence within an hour, real-time video from the overhead reconnaissance drone, and also listening. So having been in the military in those situations, in special ops units, you are alerted, and you would consider the fact that you are going to run to the sound of the guns. And you mount up, and you get ready to go. And until you're told to get the go command, you have to be ready to go. But if you don't get the go command, or you're told to stand down, do nothing. In the case of our special forces in Tripoli and their CIA compatriots, they were told to stand down and to stay right there because they anticipated trouble in Tripoli.
Right.
Well, the trouble wasn't Tripoli. The trouble was in Benghazi.
Indeed it was. Dick Brower is our guest. He is one of the senior officers associated with a marvelous organization, Special Operations Speaks. It has, among other things, amassed over 1,000 special operators as signatories on a powerful letter calling for a proper investigation, a select committee, as the colonel has just described, to get to the bottom of this Benghazi Gate scandal, which the 5 standing committees of the House of Representatives have not done to date. Colonel, in your professional judgment, you've looked at what is available in the public domain. Is there any doubt that had the order been given, we could have had, if not boots on the ground, aircraft in the air, ordnance coming from those aircraft or otherwise, brought power to bear on behalf of these folks during at least some part of that 7-hour-long attack window?
Absolutely. And as a former special operations planner, you don't just rely on special operations forces. You use all the conventional and
sure.
any other forces you have in the area. And we have it on good authority from a lieutenant general that we work with, Tom McInerney, and other flyers. And Tom has flown the F-16 out of Aviano, where we had 2 squadrons based. And he maintained, and others maintained, that with a quick launch of a flight of 2 or 4, whatever they could get airborne with extra bags of gas, they could have gone into, flown from Aviano to Sigonella, Naval Air Station Sigonella, hot refueled, which means you don't turn off the engines, taken off, and within minutes, or a very short time, been overhead of the special mission compound 20 minutes after the SEALs arrived, including their 4-hour delay that they had due to the Benghazi airport and the Libyan militia that met them and held them up, our
right.
2 brave SEALs that came from Tripoli. So we could have had conventional jets overhead to support the 2 on the roof that were under mortar fire from an 81-millimeter mortar, crew-served weapon.
And quite possibly have saved their lives. Dick Brower, I have to let you go, I'm sorry to say. Thank you for both your past service to our country and that you're engaged in at the moment. Good luck with your speech today with the Tea Party in Tallahassee. I hope you'll engage them in this effort to get to the bottom of this. It does still really make a difference. And we need to know, not least, that none of our folks are going to be left behind in the future. Again, Dick Brower, thank you for joining us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.